The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
This program contains explicit content and subject matter which may be unsuitable for some listeners. Discretion is advised. Sex Out Loud is brought to you by Good Vibrations, creating a buzz since 1977.
Smart. Sexy. Kinky. Fun.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud with your host, sex educator, author, and filmmaker, Tristan Taramino. It's sex-positive radio like you've never heard before. Tristan talks about sexuality from every angle with leading authors, experts, artists, and icons. From sex education and sexual politics to BDSM and non-monogamy, nothing is off limits. So get ready to open your mind and expand your horizons. This is Sex Out Loud. And now here's your host, Tristan Taramino.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Today we are going to tackle, well, some big topics. Obscenity, pornography, the law. We're going to take on the Supreme Court, various court cases which revolve around free speech and the First Amendment, and of course, sexual politics. Because I'm talking today with amazing historian and scholar Whitney Stroub. But first, a few pieces of housekeeping. So last week, I really encouraged you guys to donate to the Center for Sex and Culture as part of Give Out Day. Give Out Day was this day, May 15th, coordinated by Razzoo, which basically engaged hundreds of nonprofit organizations to get all these people to donate on one single day in support of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer community nonprofits. Well, they had some technical snafus yesterday, which was Thursday, May 15th, and they extended Give Out Day. So it's like Give Out Day again today, Friday, May 16th. So if you're listening to this live, you have about four more hours to donate to the Center for Sex and Culture. And the thing about it is they win prizes and they get matching grants and all sorts of things based on the number of donations, not based on the amount of donation, like the highest amount. No, it's the number of donors. So even if you go and give them $10 right now, it goes a long, long way. You can go to giveoutday.org for more information, and we'll put a direct link to the Center for Sex and Culture page on our Twitter feed. Okay. I also want to remind you that Thursday, May 22nd at 8 p.m. is the Center for Sexual Pleasure and Health's monthly sex trivia night in Providence, Rhode Island. And this month, May, Sex Out Loud is the source for the trivia contest. So if you're a big fan of Sex Out Loud, if you listen all the time and you want to go support this great organization and have a really fun time and like probably win some prizes, you should do that Thursday, May 22nd. You can go to thecsph.org for more information. Oh, and hey, we're live today and taking your calls. Just like last week, we're going to extend it for another week. You know, my birthday, I like to celebrate my birthday over and over and over again. So we are going to say that every single person who calls tonight will win a prize from Sports Sheets. That should be incentive enough, people, to get off your butts and call us at 866-472-5788, 866-472-5788. You can also post questions on our Twitter feed at Sex Out Loud Radio or on Facebook.com/AskTristan. Let me tell you about today's guest. Whitney Stroub is an associate professor of history and director of the Women's and Gender Studies program at Rutgers University, Newark. He was born on the Minnesota-Wisconsin border and grew up in Wasilla, Alaska, leaving right before Sarah Palin began her political career there. He received his PhD from UCLA and has taught at the University of Miami, UCLA, and Temple before coming to Rutgers Newark, where he's involved with the Queer Newark Oral History Project. He is the author of Perversion for Profit, The Politics of Pornography and the Rise of the New Right, and his latest book, Obscenity Rules, Roth versus the United States and the Long Struggle Over Sexual Expression. He has written for a variety of scholarly and popular venues, including Salon, Radical History Review, OutHistory.org, Journal of Women's History, and Journal of the History of Sexuality, among others. He lives in Philadelphia, where, as a critic of the concept of decency, he grapples daily with what it means and whether it's even possible to raise two decent cats. He also blogs sometimes about sexual politics, but lately mostly about cinematic representations of Newark. There's a fetish for you at strewblog.wordpress.com. Welcome to Sex Out Loud, Whit.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm thrilled to be here and happy belated birthday, by the way.
Thank you. So last year, the University Press of Kansas published your book, Obscenity Rules, Roth versus United States and the Long Struggle Over Sexual Expression. Let's begin with the subject of that book, the court case Roth v. United States. Can you just give my listeners a basic summary of what that case entailed? I know you wrote a whole book about it, and now I'm just asking you to like summarize it in 1 minute, but I know you can do it.
Yeah, sure. The sort of short version is that this was a case in 1957 involving a sort of fascinating smut merchant named Samuel Roth. And by the time it got to the Supreme Court, the court had been basically avoiding the topic of obscenity for the entirety of the 20th century. It just had not substantively weighed in on the question. And so there was just really legal chaos in the lower courts across the country. And so the Supreme Court finally, sort of felt pressured to weigh in with a legal opinion that would define obscenity. And so that's what happened in Roth v. United States in 1957. Justice William Brennan, who had just been appointed to the court quite recently, wrote a majority opinion that finally defined obscenity. It's basically been the touchstone of modern obscenity doctrine ever since. It's been modified in the intervening decades in somewhat important ways, but Roth is really still the cornerstone, even in 2014, of obscenity law today.
And does that sound frightening to you? Because it just frightens me to even think that something that was like set out in the 1950s is the basis for how we think about some of our free speech today.
Oh, absolutely. I agree completely. I mean, I pull no punches in sort of making my, ideological disposition clear in the book. I mean, it's a very critical book when it comes to looking at obscenity law. And I think Roth v. U.S. was a failure, but one that we sort of socially and politically and legally have doubled down on in the intervening decades. And, instead of questioning whether obscenity should be illegal, really just continued as a society not to confront and engage with that question in a very meaningful way.
And what historic and cultural factors do you attribute how this ruling even came down to?
Well, it was, in many ways, a legacy of the Victorian era. I mean, the first federal obscenity law, the Comstock Act in 1873, was named after Anthony Comstock, the most famous sort of smut buster of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And, Roth v. U.S. is definitely part of the legacy of that Victorian moment. I think it also reflected the anxieties and concerns of the 1950s, the Cold War era, where sexual politics, were deeply conservative and heteronormative in the United States.
And, you write that Roth deserves credit or blame each time another citizen stands behind bars for publishing pornography, which is a pretty huge, broad statement, but you actually do qualify it, and you make a pretty good case. I'm wondering if you'll flesh that out for me a little bit here.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, one of the big takeaways of Roth v. U.S. is simply the holding that obscenity is not legally protected by the First Amendment. And, you know, it's that decision by the court that allowed and continues to allow for the criminalization of obscenity. Some of the justices on the court, particularly William O. Douglas and Hugo Black, would have ruled otherwise and said the First Amendment is simply categorical and people who publish explicit sexual materials are, you know, as protected as people who publish controversial political opinions. But the court didn't go that way and, you know, has never seen fit to change that. You know, it remains a criminal act to publish, you know, representations of things that themselves might be perfectly legal among consenting adults.
And yeah, so I want people to know that too, that in many of the cases that have come down and have been based on this ruling and stuff, it's not simply about porn or hardcore visual images. This can also be applied to written images. This can be applied to illustrations. This isn't just about photography or movies.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of the sort of most significant cases, especially in the 1960s, were over written texts. I mean, it is after Roth that, you know, things like Lady Chatterley's Lover, Tropic of Cancer, Naked Lunch are publishable legally for the first time in the United States. And from there, the battle mostly does shift to visual representations and hardcore porn in the 70s.
But I think it's fascinating that there was even debate to me about simply words on the page. Like words on the page, people. No, seriously. I feel like it just wasn't that long ago that there was still sort of so much discussion about, can this be considered? It's kind of like considered a separate thing. I feel like part of what the ruling did was really set it apart from every other kind of media.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, you know, the sort of central, I think, underlying ideology of the opinion is that sexual representation, you know, is devoid of political significance or intellectual weight, or, you know, the various other alibis we use to say that certain forms of speech are more, you know, worthy than others. Sex was simply, you know, written out of politics, I think, by a court that, you know, of course, was composed of, you know, white men who certainly did not have a feminist consciousness. You know, they were not thinking in the term, you know, sexual politics itself is a phrase that I don't think would have been legible to them. You know, this is a decade before Kate Millett, you know, publishes Sexual Politics and sort of forces that concept into the discourse.
Okay, and this actually plays really nicely into, surprisingly, the fact that James Dean wrote a blog this morning about Juliette Lewis and pornography. So we've got to get into that because we actually had a listener post a question on our Twitter feed. What about James Dean? And what about what he says about Juliette Lewis? And what about artsy porn? We're gonna get to that. But first, we are going to take a break and hear from our fantastic sponsors, including Good Vibrations. You can go to Good Vibrations 24 hours a day at goodvibes.com. And while you're there, you can use coupon code Tristan for 15% off your order. And also, if you're in the San Francisco Bay Area or if you're in Brookline, Massachusetts, you can stop into one of their amazing stores, meet their fantastic sex educators who work there, who will give you great recommendations and great sex advice. Good Vibrations. I love them. They support this show and you should support them back. We are going to take a break, and when we come back, I'm going to get to this question from one of our listeners, which is about, really seriously, James Dean, Juliette Lewis, and pornography and obscenity. So we have the perfect guest for this question, and we'll get to it when we come back.
Stimulating talk gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time. The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
Good Vibrations is the San Francisco Bay Area-based women-friendly retailer trusted for more than three decades to provide a comfortable, welcoming, and safe environment for quality sex toys, educational materials, and products that enhance and empower one's sex life. Good Vibrations offers its products at six retail locations in San Francisco, Berkeley, and Oakland, California, and in Brookline, Massachusetts, as well as online at www.goodvibes.com. Online ordering is discreet and trusted. We believe that pleasure is your birthright, and one of our highly trained staff members can help you choose the product that is perfect for you at 1-800-BUY-VIBE. Call us 7 days a week from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Pacific Time at 1-800-289-8423 or visit us online at www.goodvibes.com.
Ready to take your sex life to the next level? Let Tristan Taramino's award-winning Expert Guide Sex Education Series help. Each DVD is packed with honest information, explicit techniques, scorching sex scenes, authentic chemistry, and real female orgasms. Go to puckerup.com and use coupon code SEXOUTLOUD for 25% off your order.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan at puckerup.com. That's Tristan at puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Today we're talking with Whit Strube all about obscenity and the Supreme Court, sexy stuff. We had a great question on Twitter, which actually quotes James Dean. Okay, so this question is from Susie Q, and it's really funny that she quotes James Dean because James Dean has finally confirmed that he's going to be on Sex Out Loud, people. He's going to be on a show this summer, so stay tuned. We will announce on the Twitter feed the exact date, but you know you're going to love you a show with James Dean. At the very least, Epifora will call in, I think, I hope. I don't know. So James wrote a little blog today that said, do you remember, people just kind of forgot about it, but it totally happened. Juliette Lewis did this whole thing about how awful porn was, and then like a week later, she was getting photographed with a dick inside of her. I'm all about people doing weird art porn shit or just porn for the sake of porn or whatever you want to do. But don't try to make some sexually explicit shit and pass it off as something different. Art or porn, or art porn, or anything, the concept of them being different is bullshit. Oh, wait, that's not true. One is made with a shitload more money and no safety precautions, and the other is handled in a professional manner. And dot, dot, dot. This is really just an excuse to post pictures of Juliette Lewis getting fucked on my blog, but my point is still valid. Okay, so that was a quote from James Dean, and Susie Q's question is, how does the law define art porn as opposed to, quote, regular porn if they both have hardcore explicit sex in them? Great question, Whit.
Oh, boy. Yeah. You know, I did not know that about Juliette Lewis.
I didn't know either, but apparently, you know.
Yeah, I need to get out of the archives more. No, it's a great question. I mean, I think, you know, frankly, I can't think of any examples in the 21st century where the law has really, you know, weighed in on the sort of modern wave of what I guess you'd call art porn movies. I assume we're talking about, you know, Nine Songs, Short Bus, Brown Bunny, or, you know, that whole.
Or even before that, I mean, Andy Warhol. I mean, there's, you know, there's like a history of these sort of art house pornos that definitely ride the line. They're not made and distributed commercially in the same, you know, like Bruce LaBruce to me is like, it's like on the film circuit, not, right, you know, right, in the video store kind of thing.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And I think, I mean, in the 21st century, it's a lot less relevant just because, you know, vanilla hardcore porn in general is pretty legally safe. You know, I mean, under George W. Bush, that was a little tenuous, but certainly under Obama, you know, we all know that hardcore porn is not really under attack. But I do think that, you know, there have been flashpoints in the history of obscenity law where that was less the case. And certainly, you know, your point about Andy Warhol is well taken. You know, the queer avant-garde of the 60s. I mean, when we talk about underground cinema of the 60s, you know, primarily we are talking about a queer world of, you know, Andy Warhol, the Kuchar brothers, Kenneth Anger. And yeah, those movies were very, very frequently legally targeted. You know, Jack Smith's Flaming Creatures was, you know, targeted legally in California, Michigan, New York. Kenneth Anger's movies were regularly prosecuted in Los Angeles. So all the way through the mid-60s, I mean, Scorpio Rising, you know, his sort of queer biker fetish film, you know, it's impossible today to think of that as anything but a canonical moment in the history of underground cinema. But, you know, as late as 64 in Los Angeles, it was declared legally obscene and actually convicted. That was overturned on appeal. But you know, I think in those moments, that had a lot less to do with the sort of artsiness of the movies than their queer qualities. You know, one of the themes that I think runs through all of the writing that I do on the history of obscenity law is that there's always been, you know, a heavy bias in obscenity law against anything deemed queer in one way or another. And in that sense, I don't think artistic merit has often protected those works the way that you might expect it to.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the fascinating pieces is that technically under the law, these distinctions become kind of arbitrary and they become up to the eye of the beholder. I mean, I think a crucial part of the Roth ruling that you talk about in the book is this notion of community standards. And can you explain like why that's so critical and also why it's so problematic and how it has impacted legal precedent going forward, this whole notion of community standards and who the community even is?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, what William Brennan writes in Roth in 1957, and I apologize if this gets dry, but it is short.
You know, it's about porn. It's not dry.
All right. Well, if we can convince people of that, I'll roll with it. What Brennan writes is that obscenity is what is to the average person applying contemporary community standards, that which taken as a whole appeals to prurient interest. And so those are kind of the three prongs of obscenity doctrine: the average person, the contemporary community standards, and appealing to prurient interest. And I think, you know, if we look at all three of those concepts in their historical moment, what they meant in 1950s America, you know, they're completely ideologically loaded with sexual politics that, you know, the court is not acknowledging. You know, however it might sound in the abstract, the reality is, you know, trials don't happen in the abstract. They happen, you know, in political realities. And so the average person, you know, already we're assuming that the legal arbiter here is a presumptively, you know, middle-class, white, male, and obviously heterosexual. You know, that carries over into the idea of contemporary community standards. We're talking, you know, an era here where homosexuality, masturbation, even adultery are criminal acts. And prurient interest as well is another one of these incredibly slippery and elusive phrases, right? I mean, what is prurient interest? Well, you know, it's some kind of lecherous sexual desire that we, the average person, don't approve of. And there's really no better way to define it than that. I mean, Brennan puts a footnote, you know, he's a very smart legal writer. He's actually in many ways, you know, possibly the greatest justice on the Supreme Court during this era. And yet, you know, he reflects the sort of blind spots of his time. And so he tries to sort of reason this away with this footnote defining prurient interest. And it's just this chain of synonyms. You know, he's not able to actually define it because, you know, there is really no definition beyond, you know, sexual stuff that we don't approve of. And so, you know, that's the heart of obscenity law. It's this sort of disgust and revulsion all based on the prejudices of, you know, a very homophobic society. But it's written in this legal language where none of that is necessarily immediately obvious to the reader. It looks very dry and legalistic.
And don't you think it also then became a sort of a strategic move in some cases when, in fact, porn was being made and distributed in places like San Francisco and New York City, it was, you know, the community standards of these incredibly urban, sophisticated, sexually savvy, emergingly queer places, no one was going to say, hey, that's obscene and that's prurient. So then they began sending things through the mail and doing these sting operations and trying to convict people in other places where they felt like, okay, this stuff may fly in San Francisco, but let's get some undercover person to send it, you know, to Utah, and then we're talking. Because we know the people in Utah are going to say, no, this is perverted and this is weird. So then it becomes this matter of like geography and breaks down around these weird like class and geographical segments, because community standards have to apply to like wherever it was made or where it was distributed or where it was received. And so it becomes kind of a strategy for getting people, for kind of, you know, trapping people, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that becomes one of the more contentious, you know, legal doctrinal questions of the 1960s when it comes to obscenity is, you know, what do we mean by community? You know, do we mean San Francisco? Do we mean California? Do we mean the United States as a whole? And there's a whole lot of debate over that legally, you know, within the Supreme Court and within the legal system as a whole. Ultimately, you know, during the 1960s, we have a famously liberal Supreme Court. Of course, you know, Earl Warren is Chief Justice. This is the famous Warren Court that's very progressive on civil rights issues and also free speech for the most part. And so by the late 1960s, the courts made it pretty clear when we say community standards, we mean national community standards. And so, you know, they make it much harder to do those kind of sting operations where, you know, a smut dealer in Los Angeles gets arrested in, you know, Montana or Utah. But that sort of robust free speech doctrine doesn't last very long. You know, as you know, we were talking before the show about the Miller standards. You know, there's a serious backsliding on the court in the 1970s. Richard Nixon, you know, gets elected president in 1968, makes it one of his missions to restock the court with conservatives. And he's very successful at that, especially on matters of free speech and sexuality. He's able to make four appointments and, you know, Earl Warren retires. Then what we see is, you know, a very newly conservative Supreme Court in the 70s, which in 1973, in the case Miller v. California, decides that community standards are in fact not national anymore, but now are local or regional. And so they essentially reopen the door to doing exactly what you were just talking about. You know, there was this sort of window in the 60s of, you know, somewhat more protection. But starting in 73, we go back to a moment where, you know, yeah, you can be arrested in Los Angeles and, you know, brought to Utah or Memphis, Tennessee to face charges.
And not all these pornographers, I mean, some of these cases that you talk about in both your books, you know, not all these pornographers are like the big, like Larry Flint, like crusaders with endless bank accounts to fund, you know, their principles. Like, it was kind of amazing to me that some of these guys fought it out for as long as they did, because they didn't necessarily like have anyone backing them up on it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, a lot of the time, you know, they had very little choice but to do so. They didn't always have support from the ACLU, but, you know, this was just a matter of life and death to many of these publishers. You know, one of the cases I find really fascinating is two publishers in Fresno, California, Sanford Aday and Wallace Day Ortega Maxey, who were arrested, faced charges in Michigan and were convicted for publishing these pulp novels that weren't even that explicit by the context of the 60s. Unfortunately, one of them was titled Sex Life of a Cop, and it appeared to irritate the authorities. They were actually...
Which is kind of funny. It wasn't even that sexy, though.
No, it's you know, it's not even a very interesting book. It's certainly not that explicit. But they were actually sentenced to 25 years in prison for publishing this book, and they had to spend about half of the decade of the 1960s fighting this. They lost at every level of appeal, all the way up to the Supreme Court, which finally reversed without comment in 67. But I mean, you know, when you think about the toll that this takes on a person, you know, spending half of a decade facing 25 years in prison, going broke, fighting the charges, I mean, it is quite staggering to remember that that's, you know, the very recent past. And, you know, that extends well beyond the 60s, of course. In the 70s, you know, Harry Reams is arrested in New York City and hauled to Memphis to face obscenity charges for participating in Deep Throat. You know, we like to think of the 70s as a very liberated decade, but this is, you know, still going on then.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that both your books does is really bring to light some of these smaller cases that aren't in the quote-unquote history books, or when we do this kind of survey of the history of it, we don't hear about some of these really small-time pornographers who were facing intense, intense jail time and fines and fought a really good fight. I mean, I feel like all of these stories have like some fascinating little like backstory element to them, and you get kind of caught up in it and you're like, I can't believe this. And the most fascinating thing about it is they all feel very ordinary. And maybe that's because I'm looking back on it and it's like what was freaking people out in the 1960s and 70s, you know, isn't what's freaking people out now. But I just think it's a real, gosh, it's just a real, it gives you such perspective on how these taboos and these mores have shifted, but how there is always something that's considered not normal. Like, well, that stuff's okay, but this stuff is horrible. And these lines get really flimsy and blurry. But look, I'm running over time. We've got to take another break. I want you to think on that and sure. Respond to that when we come back. Let's take a break and hear from our sponsors, including WeVibe. Have you been to WeVibe.com? They have redesigned almost their entire line of products. They have new colors. They have new designs. You've got to check it out. I love the Tango, which is great. It's a great summer vibrator. You know why, people? Because you can take it on vacation. Actually, you can take all their vibes on vacation. But I just like the Tango because like you can put it in your pocket and no one at TSA will say anything about it. So go to WeVibe.com to find out more. And when we come back, we will talk more about these sexual taboos and obscenity laws with Whitney Stroub. So stay with us.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com.
Turn off the TV and pick up the remote control that is sure to please. Worn while making love, the WeVibe 3 features whisper quiet motors that will keep you anything but quiet. We can't help it if the rechargeable battery lasts longer than you do. Learn more about the world's number one vibrator for couples at WeVibe.com. WeVibe. Share the pleasure.
Good Vibrations is the San Francisco Bay Area-based women-friendly retailer trusted for more than three decades to provide a comfortable, welcoming, and safe environment for quality sex toys, educational materials, and products that enhance and empower one's sex life. Good Vibrations offers its products at six retail locations in San Francisco, Berkeley, and Oakland, California, and in Brookline, Massachusetts, as well as online at www.goodvibes.com. Online ordering is discreet and trusted. We believe that pleasure is your birthright, and one of our highly trained staff members can help you choose the product that is perfect for you at 1-800-BUY-VIBE. Call us 7 days a week from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Pacific Time at 1-800-289-8423 or visit us online at www.goodvibes.com.
Ready to take your sex life to the next level? Let Tristan Taramino's award-winning expert guide sex education series help. Each DVD is packed with honest information, explicit techniques, scorching sex scenes, authentic chemistry, and real female orgasms. Go to puckerup.com and use coupon code SEXOUTLOUD for 25% off your order.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Time flies when you're talking about porn and obscenity, doesn't it? So I'm talking with Whitney Strube about his two great books, Obscenity Rules and Perversion for Profit. I was rambling on at the end right before the break, and I want to give you a chance to respond to my ramble about how, a theme throughout all of these obscenity prosecutions is kind of parsing out what is considered normal or acceptable sexuality and what is considered deviant or obscene or, like you said, prurient.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think you said it well before the break. The reality is the content shifts over time, right? I mean, in the 50s, it's Lady Chatterley's Lover and adultery and the word fuck. And then in the mid-1960s, it might be women's breasts. And by the late 60s, it's full frontal nudity. And in the 70s, hardcore, et cetera, et cetera. But the structures remain very much the same, right? I mean, the logic and the rhetoric of obscenity is always about defining these boundaries of the socially permissible and basically sexual citizenship, right? I mean, it's who's going to be included in the sort of sexual body politic. And in that, at that level, these debates, I mean, they're remarkably unchanging, right? I mean, you follow this from the 1870s to the 1930s, all the way through the 21st century, and that logic really never wavers. I mean, it becomes, it's almost monotonous in a way. The details of the cases are always fascinating, but the trajectory of them, I mean, it just never changes.
And I think that's one of the fascinating links you make in your book, Perversion for Profit. You have an entire chapter devoted to anti-porn feminism, and it's really not pretty, by which I mean, well, you talk about how history has kind of gotten the sex wars wrong. And I think one of the fascinating things that you draw this connection between is how these anti-porn feminists really did join with these right-wing conservatives and overlooked a bunch of really homophobic, anti-woman rhetoric in order to kind of join forces against this evil that was pornography.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly do see that in the 1980s, and it's, I think it's very problematic. I mean, Andrea Dworkin and Catherine MacKinnon working with the Mies Commission, set up by the Ronald Reagan administration, which is overtly anti-feminist and homophobic. The Mies Commission, part of its report is about how horrible porn is because there's all this gay cruising in porn shops, and that's just morally offensive. So it's kind of shocking and disappointing at the same time to see feminists who are so progressive on other issues, essentially colluding in that, even as they refuse to acknowledge the existence of sex-positive feminists who are taking, I think, a much more complicated and nuanced tack on the issue.
And that's the other thing about the Mies Commission that I found so fascinating is before the Mies Commission, there was the Presidential Commission on Obscenity and Pornography appointed by Johnson. And it seemed like they had the time and the money to really study this issue. And they came to a whole bunch of conclusions that basically porn was harmless and that there was no real link between porn and violent behavior or crime. And in fact, people exposed to porn often had an open mind and less repression and were better off for it. Okay, that's like a massive oversimplification, but it did seem like they had this kind of serious social science behind them to make these conclusions, and yet it didn't stick. Why?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of that just has to do with the rise of the new right and Ronald Reagan and this new, family values, so-called agenda in the 1980s. I mean, if you look at the president's report on the President's Commission on Obscenity and Pornography in 1970, when it comes out, I mean, it is driven by social science, and they absolutely and explicitly refuse to rely on public hearings, which they think are, you know, too emotionally driven and sensationalized and distorted. And they're absolutely right about that. Now, their report, I think, is not impeccable. They're very indifferent to questions of gender and power. You know, it's not by any means a perfect report, but it does have, you know, a very substantial body of social science that suggests that, you know, sort of social narratives of pornography and deviance and juvenile delinquents and sexual violence are all misplaced. You know, those are very convincing conclusions that it reaches. Now, when the Mies Commission is established by Ronald Reagan in 1985, it has no, you know, there's no mandate here to study the issue. It's made explicitly clear that this is a commission that, you know, the conclusion is already drawn. They're going to, you know, attack pornography as a social evil and support further measures against it. And so they never do any social science or any research to speak of at all. They just hold a lot of hearings where people tell stories that are sometimes, you know, sort of wildly excessive and kind of patently ridiculous at times, but then they, you know, rely on that plus a sort of distortion of the existing social science literature to create this new narrative that, you know, porn leads to violence and child abuse and sexual deviation and should be further criminalized. You know, it's a ridiculously just polemical and ideologically driven committee from the start, which is why, you know, it's so problematic that some anti-porn feminists are working with it.
Well, and it just feels like they threw out everything that they learned from the other commission as if it sort of never existed.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, that was wholly intentional and by design. I mean, the Mies Commission was stacked with right-wing, anti-porn, pro-decency and family values members. So there was never any doubt that that would be exactly what would happen.
We've got a caller, which means we also have a winner, people. That's what callers are on this show. They're winners. They win prizes from Sports Sheets. And Sports Sheets is an amazing company. You're going to get one of their fabulous prizes. We've got Paula.
Hi, this is Paulette from Seattle.
Hi, Paula.
So I have a question. What counts as porn today, and some specifics? Does the graphic novel Bread and Wine by Samuel Delaney count? Or do some of the films by Toby Hill Meyer from Seattle, like there's a DVD set called Doing It Ourselves, The Trans Women Porn Project? Are those porn?
Good question. What counts as porn today? Well, this kind of gets us back to Miller, which, I mean, here's my thought is, like, I feel like there's been all these cases since the Miller case, but then it feels like Miller still reigns as the existing definition of what's obscene and what's not. Would you agree with that or would you disagree with that?
Yeah, I'd agree with that completely. I mean, Miller has been certainly modified in some very, you know, minor and fairly arcane ways since 1973, but it is still the governing precedent when it comes to obscenity. It's the go-to case. Although I think, you know, it's a great question too. And I think it raises the question of the difference between pornography and obscenity, which is a very important distinction. I mean, obscenity is a legal concept. You know, obscenity is criminal and is not protected by the First Amendment. Pornography, you know, is a social and cultural concept, but technically it's not a legal term. I mean, pornography has never been criminal as pornography per se. It's criminal because it's obscene. And so in the 21st century, you know, and I'm so glad you mentioned these cases. Samuel Delaney is somebody I just absolutely love and admire. When I taught at Temple, you know, technically he was my colleague in the creative writing department, and I just absolutely love his work in science fiction and queer theory and autobiography. And I think both he, and Toby Humiller, who I believe Tristan was in your book, The Feminist Porn Book.
Yes.
They would both self-identify as pornographers and quite proudly at that. And so, you know, the question of is their work porn, I think the answer they would both agree is yes, although they would certainly qualify that in many ways, you know, in terms of explaining what they meant. You know, is it obscene in the 21st century? You know, I think the answer is clearly at this point, no. Although, you know, the kind of transgressive material that they both deal in, you know, has been in a very precarious position in the 21st century, you know, much less so after, you know, the election of Barack Obama. But under the Bush administration, you know, there was a wave of prosecutions of sort of kinky and transgressive porn, you know, stuff involving simulated rape and scat, you know, squirting porn, you know, all of this stuff that, you know, might or might not be ideologically problematic to some of us, but was certainly done by consenting adults, and yet was prosecuted very, very successfully and effectively under the George W. Bush, you know, 8 years of hell. And so, you know, I think even now obscenity is in a state of flux. You know, I mean, if we elect a Republican president, which, you know, let us all hope that never happens, but were it to be the case, you know, every candidate in 2012 pledged to revive adult obscenity laws and prosecutions. And I think we know exactly what they mean when they say that. You know, they're not going to go after mainstream heterosexual vanilla porn because nobody's going to convict that even in, you know, pretty small locations. What they're going to go after are the things on the sexual fringes like Delaney, you know, like, you know, the sort of kinkier end of the porn spectrum.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree. Okay. We've got to take another break, but that was such a smarty pants question.
Yeah.
So
no, that was,
a really smarty pants question. And I think we can talk about it a little bit more after the break, but first let's hear from our sponsors, including Astroglide. Astroglide has been a supporter of mine for so many years, and I'm super psyched that they have this new glycerin and paraben-free gel. It's called the Sensitive Skin Gel. It's great for anal. And you know what goes great with Astroglide? Aneros. Aneros has also been a great supporter of mine, and their prostate toys and their fabulous Kegel toy, the Eevee, they're unmatched. They're really the best toys on the market, period, hands down. So, think about it. Aneros, Astroglide, good match. When we come back, we will wrap up this discussion on obscenity. I still have so many questions. And you know what? You can still give us a call and win a prize. Did you see how easy that was? That person just called up and won a prize just like that. You can call us too. 866-472-5788. 866-472-5788. It's the last segment, people, your last chance to win a Sports Sheets prize. So stay with us.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
Looking to add something fun and different to your sexual experiences? Then try Astroglide X, premium silicone personal lubricant. Astroglide X contains a unique blend of high-quality silicones that provide a silky smooth experience unlike any other. Astroglide X is also waterproof and perfect for water play. Not only does Astroglide X last longer than all water-based products and is hypoallergenic and latex safe, it's even great for massage. For more information and a free sample, visit astroglide.com.
Good Vibrations is the San Francisco Bay Area-based women-friendly retailer trusted for more than three decades to provide a comfortable, welcoming, and safe environment for quality sex toys, educational materials, and products that enhance and empower one's sex life. Good Vibrations offers its products at six retail locations in San Francisco, Berkeley, and Oakland, California, and in Brookline, Massachusetts, as well as online at www.goodvibes.com. Online ordering is discreet and trusted. We believe that pleasure is your birthright, and one of our highly trained staff members can help you choose the product that is perfect for you at 1-800-BUY-VIBE. call us 7 days a week from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Pacific Time at 1-800-289-8423 or visit us online at www.goodvibes.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Today we're talking with the historian and legal expert, scholar, Whitney Strube, all about obscenity. And, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show, and one of the things that becomes so clear, especially in reading your two books back to back, is that although Roth v. United States was a 1957 case, and in Perversion for Profit, you trace these issues of obscenity and pornography in the legal system from way, way back, these are still incredibly relevant today for pornographers making work today. And I think people don't realize that. I think that we take for granted that we kind of live in this ultra-liberal, progressive society, and we've got a Democrat in the White House, and so it's like, we're all good. But the fact of the matter is, people have been thrown in jail for obscenity. People have been charged with obscenity and have had to fight legal fights in the very, very recent history. So this is still very much an issue for pornographers, especially those pornographers who are making work that's on the fringe or what mainstream society would consider the fringe. What do you think the state of obscenity prosecutions is right now?
Well, right now, you know, prosecutions are clearly in remission. You know, the Obama Justice Department has made pretty clear they're not interested in, you know, pursuing these cases. You know, they're not doing the moral grandstanding that Bush and Reagan and other Republicans, you know, sort of build their careers off of to win favor with the Christian right. You know, that being said, I think even during the Obama years, we've seen things like the wave of kind of moral panic and indignation towards sexting, in which, you know, teens are criminalized for the very act of sending naked pictures of themselves at times. You know, these sex laws still continue to reverberate and haunt us. You know, they haven't gone anywhere. I think they're just sort of on ice during a relatively socially liberal administration.
But it feels like they're in danger of not being on ice because the precedence is still there. And so for anyone who wants to go after pornographers or who wants to prosecute, I feel like they've got some legs to stand on.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I would agree with that. I think, you know, I think you're not likely to see that happening federally anytime too soon. But at the more local and state level, I mean, it's, you know, it's generally a sort of can't lose proposition in conservative districts for district attorneys to go after obscenity, you know, whether or not they're going to have sustainable cases. I mean, you know, they generate headlines, they establish moral credibility, if that's what matters in those kind of districts. And so I agree with you completely that, you know, we should absolutely not think of this as some kind of past that's no longer with us. I mean, these are risks that people continue to absolutely run who are, you know, at the boundaries of what we would consider sexual citizenship in the 21st century.
So you've written two books on the subject, which makes me think, I know this is bold, but you seem like you might be obsessed with obscenity. Do you agree with that or not? And why?
Well, you know, I think in some ways it might be the opposite. I may have been, and then, you know, writing two books sort of runs its course. I mean, I don't know whether this is your experience as somebody who's been in the trenches even longer than me in a much more hands-on way, but, you know, frankly, I kind of am done with the topic. I'm thinking about writing on, you know, left-wing filmmakers and kind of anything that will avoid making me go back to, you know, legal doctrine for the near future.
You think this might have sort of scratched the itch?
Well, I mean, I've still got some works in progress. I'm co-editing a collection, actually, with Carolyn Bronstein, who wrote a great book.
An incredible book on anti-porn feminists. Yes.
Yeah, Carolyn is amazing. And the two of us together are co-editing a collection of essays on porn in the 1970s in the U.S. So, you know, I guess I'm still stuck with the issue for a while. And I think there's a lot left to be said, honestly. You know, there's been so much done in porn studies in the last 25 years since Linda Williams published her book Hardcore. But there's still a lot that hasn't been done, especially, I think, more historical approaches to some of these questions rather than sort of film theory approaches.
Which I think is part of the appeal of your book is that, especially Perversion for Profit, is that I've read, obviously, a lot of stuff about all of this, but you do really take such a historical look at all the forces, all the political and social and historical forces at work that affect these legal cases. I mean, you it's like you take it, you have a really wide shot. I mean, in filmic terms, like you've stepped way, way, way back and you've showed us kind of the entire context. And so what I love about it is it's such a thorough history, and it really, it arms kind of anyone out there with a really firm grasp on sexual politics in these like legal considerations and how they really speak to like so much more than just these cases. They become kind of emblematic of like what we are preoccupied with at that moment in history and what's like freaking us out or what's, you know, what's violating our community standards individually or collectively. And I mean that, you know, literally and metaphorically. You know, I think that this, I just think anyone who is into this stuff, any of my sex geeks out there in listener land will love these two books because they're dense. But they're so rich in amazing history and in putting all of this stuff in a context that is just really powerful, I think, in the end.
Wow, well, thank you. That's incredibly kind and generous, and it means a lot coming from you. You know, I'm a big admirer of your work. I think maybe the one thing I'd add is that, you know, the real fetish I do have that, you know, hopefully is reflected in some of that is just digging into archives. I mean, you know, I spent in grad school almost the better part of a year living in a minivan, driving around from archive to archive. And I mean, there's so much fascinating stuff you can extrapolate from that isn't otherwise in the public record. And, you know, I think that to me is part of the real thrill of writing this kind of historical work, you know, just working through box after box of, you know, folders with God knows what in them, you know, correspondence and legal files and just the sort of fascinating raw materials of history.
Yeah, I mean, it ties so nicely. And, you know, I've been pushing everyone to donate to the Center for Sex and Culture because they had this big give out, you know, day yesterday and today. And it ties so nicely in that because there are some historical pieces, especially around like really, really early queer porn that I didn't even know until I read about them in your book. So I was like, okay, this is something I didn't know. Like this is really good stuff. So I recommend your books to all the geeks out there listening. And I really appreciate you coming on my show.
Oh, well, thank you so much. It was a real pleasure and an honor to be here.
Whitney Strube is the author of Perversion for Profit, The Politics of Pornography and the Rise of the New Right, and the new one, Obscenity Rules, Roth v. United States and the Long Struggle Over Sexual Expression. He blogs at Strublog, strublog.wordpress.com. All of these links and more can be found at sexoutloudradio.com. Click on the link for episode resources. You can always find me at puckerup.com and on Twitter at Tristan Taramino. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. You know your names. And tune in next Friday at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, when my guest will be none other than Belle Knox, the Duke University student who came out as a porn star to a tremendous amount of media scrutiny and backlash. Man, do I have some questions for her. So until then, I encourage you to keep the discussion going on Facebook.com/AskTristan, on Twitter at SexOutLoudRadio, and in your own life. Take some time to talk about sex out loud.
That's a wrap on today's show. Go to voiceamerica.com to listen to this and other episodes on demand or as podcasts. And make sure you come back next Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific, for Sex Out Loud with Tristan Taramino on Voice America Variety.
Sex Out Loud is brought to you by Good Vibrations, creating a buzz since 1977.